This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. We're back for another episode in our coverage of COVID-19 and mental health. And this one is actually going to be the penultimate episode. So next week is going to be our last episode as part of this special series before we go back to our more regular episodes covering a different factor in mental health each week. So that could be a specific mental illness or a more general factor in mental health. So for that last episode, we have a special interview planned to look back on lockdown so far and also look into the future and adapting and coping with mental health ups and downs as lockdown continues to ease and we adjust to a new normal.
Wow, I just can't believe how long it's been.
I know.
Are we now, week 12?
Yep, so we are week 12 of lockdown and next week's episode will be the 12th episode because, of course, we missed a week for the Hope from the Frontline one.
Wow, 12 weeks.
It is really significant because we always knew this would have to come to an end at some point. We can't cover the pandemic forever. And I think when we started, if you remember our first ever episode, whilst it was recorded on the Monday that lockdown started, it was recorded before that was announced. And so at that point, you know, we didn't even know that the UK was going to be in lockdown by the time the episode was released, let alone how long this period was going to last. And ultimately, at some point, you have to get back to pre-existing mental illness or what's come up beyond the pandemic. Because for a lot of people, the pandemic ending isn't going to be a fix in and of itself.
Yeah, and I'm not sure how there's a cut and dry line. You know, we have to end in terms of the episodes. Well, we don't have to, but it's time to. And as you said, go back to our normal. But to be honest, how long will it be when we're not all still referring to this last 12 weeks, you know?
It is going to be a really weird one. And that's something that the listeners will notice reflected in the content. So we have still been recording some regular interviews during this time. So on other themes to COVID-19. In those, we've specifically not talked about the pandemic because we had no idea yet when they'd be released. And so we didn't want them to seem outdated or something to be said that then turned out to be wrong in terms of like how we've learned that the symptoms are more than what initially scientists believed, for example. And so in those episodes, it's not referred to. In the intros that we record separately for them, we may well still continue talking about the pandemic a little bit, but it's come time where we need to broaden out our content again. That being said, the lockdown interviews, the bonus ones that go out on Mondays, they will continue. So we'll keep recording those. So there will still be coverage, but just our main Thursday episodes will go back to normal after next week's.
Yeah.
And we've got some really brilliant ones coming up, including from many of the guests you've heard via the lockdown interviews as well. So we're really pleased with the content to come. And part of this is, it's difficult to wait any longer to get that out to you. It's such good conversations.
Amazing. I've been really excited about getting them out, actually. So you're right. It's all positive stuff that will come out of it because we have had, within the COVID episodes and the general episodes that we've still recorded, they've all just been fantastic, haven't they? I think we've had 12 weeks of some absolutely brilliant conversations.
Yeah. I'm really pleased with them. They've been hard work. You know, this isn't usual for us. We can normally record a few weeks in advance at the very least, whereas right now we're recording on Mondays for episodes on Thursday. So it's a really quick turnaround. And even within that quick turnaround, often the news has changed by Thursday. And so I'm then doing the final edits after Pete's done the main edit. And sometimes I have to take things out because the news has changed so significantly.
Yeah.
We've had things that we've mentioned on a Monday, and then by the Thursday, there's been a change of decision. So that's been very strange to navigate.
Yeah.
So, yeah,
I guess I've had the easiest role out of the three of us because I come and enjoy the content and record with you. But you and Pete, you've been busy bees editing, producing, like literally so quickly, as you said, to maintain the standard of the podcast, but whilst trying to really be relevant and authentic. have to work really hard on it. So well done.
Thank you. It has been challenging, so I am kind of looking forward to getting back to our more usual structure at this point. Oh, and here's a fun thing you haven't realised yet, is the episode that came out on Monday is Sophie Savage's episode, and you unknowingly gave a preview of her main episode, because in the intro we talked a little bit about what we got from the episode, and you mentioned her referring to grief as an expression of love, and that you found that way of looking at grief really impactful as understanding why it is something we have to go through as a reflection of love. And it helped you kind of reframe that in your head. And that was actually something she talked about in her main interview we did on grief, not the bonus interview.
I spilt the beans.
Yes.
So I'm saying.
Basically, so I thought I should mention that for the listeners in case they're wondering. But Danielle mentioned something really powerful, and yet I don't know where she got it from.
She made it up.
But I left it in because you phrased it well, and that's a little surprise preview for the listeners. So there will be a full episode from Sophie Savage coming soonish. So in the meantime, talking of challenges of lockdown, and I had a really excellent segue that I don't want to lose. What was that? Okay, I've remembered. The segue is talking of, as you mentioned, trying to be authentic and relevant with how the experience of lockdown is. I'm quite keen to check in on how we're both doing.
Oh, it's been a struggle this last week, to be honest. I don't know why I would say to be honest, because I'm not ever going to say anything that's not honest. So it's just a phrase that I use all the time. Like, to be honest, that is.
So to be dishonest, I'm absolutely fine.
Yeah, that's it. I think it's because the last couple of weeks have been uncertain. The first few weeks we were so good with the kids, and obviously the weather was amazing. You know, trying to work and trying to homeschool, but it all seemed to enjoying it, even though it was in really sad times. But then, like lately, because maybe we're thinking things are kind of getting back to normal, and everybody's starting to step out a bit. And this week we've had terrible weather, so we've been indoors, and it's just.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned off air that it was like the novelty has worn off now.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. And I think I'm probably not the only one. Some of the listeners might kind of get what I'm saying. Yeah, the novelty just seems to be, I'm just a bit like, oh, I think I've done well because it's 12 weeks in and I'm only kind of starting to feel that now. I guess maybe week 9 or week 10, it started to kick in. But yeah, I'm ready for the next thing. I'm a bit over it. And then you worry that we might all start stepping out a bit too early and everybody's so over it that we're just dying to get back to normal, and that's a bit worrying. And obviously with what happened with George Floyd and all the protests, that's really added to the emotion of this week.
Yeah, of course, we should definitely talk about that shortly as well, but I've had a very similar experience. It's almost like even apart, we've kind of emotionally synced up. So one thing I don't know if I've mentioned much during this is that over the last few weeks, I've been really grappling with my sleep. And I'm normally someone that is really okay with sleeping, to the point where at times I can be accused of being a bit smug with it, because I know how much people's sleep affects them. We even did an episode on it previously of sleep as a factor in mental health. And I've got a lot of friends that really struggle, you know, long term with that. And generally, when I hit the pillow, I'm just ready to be out. And I have a pretty good gauge on whether I'm tired or not. And once I am, give me a soft surface and I'm gone. And during the pandemic, that's really changed. And initially, I thought, oh, well, I'm sleeping in more because I'm not up as early on certain days. And so maybe it's that I've just shifted my body clock and that's why I'm up late at night. And so a few weeks ago, I tried to change it back. So I would set an earlier alarm for myself. So normally for me, for context, 1 a.m. is my bedtime, which I know might be quite late for a lot of people. But then luckily, I have a type of work where I can normally get up at 9 a.m. So I still get my 8 hours. Whereas it was getting to the point where I was struggling to sleep before 4 or 5 p.m. You know, the sun was starting to come up, and that psychologically seems to really do something to me. Yeah, really mess with I guess, my perception of time and my feeling of well-being, you know, and then can lead into contributing to depression symptoms as well. So I've tried to shift that back and been setting, you know, at least get into bed by midnight and then just, you know, see if you can sleep or listen to a podcast rather than watching a video, or, you know, try and do things, maybe have a bath before bed. You know, all these little things that can be good sleep hygiene, and yet it's not had a huge impact. And particularly the last few nights and over the weekend, I've really struggled with that. And I think a lot of that is what's happening in the news. It's becoming harder and harder to understand what all the lockdown rules are at this stage and grapple with the ethics around that. It's like we now have to prioritise the rules because some of them have started to conflict. There's so many. Yeah, I found that really tough going. And so the last few nights, I've really struggled to sleep. And a lot of my friends are struggling. And so I'm worrying about them as well, which won't be helping. And so, you know, the last weekend, but also the last week in general, I have been feeling pretty depressed.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think at the moment, I think that's probably happening across for so many people in terms of not only are we worrying about the unlocking of all of this, really. I think it is adding to people. I think we've been through this middle section of feeling quite good and we came together. You're absolutely right. It was a great point. And now, well, with Black Lives Matter and with pandemic being all the changes that are starting to happen, it's all gone a little bit crazy again. I'm a bit unsure, a bit uncertain. And
yeah, it's almost like we're back to pre-lockdown again. That everyone was worrying about, when will the lockdown happen? Will I have enough things? Where's all the toilet roll gone? And it feels a bit like we're going back to that again, you know, and it's pretty scary. And I've seen a lot of the concerns around that. So, for example, obviously we've talked at length about the schools going back. And as part of that, I posted the episode we did with Natasha onto the petition that we have for mental health education in the UK. There are many, many parents that have signed that. And in fact, this week we're almost at 200,000 signatures.
Wow!
Yeah. So side note, if you haven't yet signed that or want to learn more about mental health education, the link is every week in the episode description.
Please do.
Anyway, so that's quick plug. But the important thing was I shared that, and at the same time I asked for the opinions of parents because I thought, you know, me, you and Natasha had quite similar perspectives on this. So I wanted to check, really, are we representative? And for the most part, yes. Above 80% of people that commented on that update were saying it's too soon and were questioning the logic about it. You know, is it more economic as opposed to a health thing? You know, they cited scientists that had come out against it. They talked about the kids of the royal family hadn't gone back and yet their kids were expected to, and the majority of them were questioning why it's been done. And I think that is what a lot of us are experiencing now.
Yeah, you're right. It's the confusion, because right in the middle of all of this, where there was just nothing that we could do and this is what we're doing, when the world seemed to all be locked down and we'd managed to get toilet roll and we'd managed to get food, but we were wearing gloves and masks and we were wiping everything down, when there was just nothing else that was a choice, we all seemed slightly more content and happy. We were reflecting, we were gardening, we were watching new things on TV, we were sewing, you know, we were doing stuff. Don't get me wrong, we know that there's a lot of pain and not everybody's just gardening. But as soon as then questions, there comes an opportunity for choices, we all start to feel that confusion and nervousness again, you know, because, I mean, one, for me, you know, my daughter's school opened today and I've got a year one child. Has she gone back? No. It's been a bit of debating in my household. It's been a bit of a debate within my own self. So many different factors of why or not. And in the end, I've just thought, you know, she's not going back and not, don't worry about it. But I've spent the last week in turmoil about it.
Yeah. And I think you've hit the nail on the head that as things are being lifted, it seems to be happening in such a way where more of the onus is on us. You know, and Boris keeps referencing things like the British people will use their common sense. It's a strange thing to hear when the government keeps saying they're not making decisions without advice of their senior scientists. And I'm sat here thinking, I don't have senior scientists, joking about it just because I know that their decisions are a lot bigger than my decisions.
Yeah,
because they're the ones enforcing them. But, you know, it is a weird thing to hear that we're expected to use our common sense, and yet the government, their common sense isn't good enough. Their common sense isn't seen to be safe, and therefore they have advisors. So, it, you know, it's a weird thing, and it does feel like the pressure is on all of us to make the decisions, and that can create a lot of emotional strain and a lot of stress. You're questioning, am I doing the right thing?
Absolutely.
And then between us, we're debating it. You know, I've got family members that are saying, you'd come round for a drink, wouldn't you? And I'm like, not really.
Even the protest, Bobby, we've been allowed to protest, haven't we? But then we're being told we shouldn't be protesting. And there's so much debate around that because the social distancing. But it's not been disallowed. It wasn't illegal. We weren't told no protests
were allowed.
Oh.
Unfortunately, it's a bit more complicated than that. So it is technically illegal because the rules around not more than six people gathering have now been put into law. So on the basis of that, whilst it's not illegal to protest, if there's more than six of you, it is. So it is essentially illegal to protest. And that's where it's like weirdly kind of nuanced. So the government aren't going to say it's illegal to protest, but we know. Unless there's only six of you, there's no way you can have one. And I talked about it last week, didn't I? I said, I don't know what I'm going to do when the protests come to Birmingham, as I expect they will. And I have the answer on that now for you, which is I did go to the protest. Mm. So around 4,000 people protested in Birmingham, and it was entirely peaceful. There were no arrests made. There was no police intervention. In fact, for most of it, I didn't even see police officers. They were very much waiting on the sidelines.
I felt proud of Birmingham for that.
Yeah, that's exactly the feeling I found. You know, seeing all those people there, including many of my friends who I didn't know were going, including two of my cousins, including Katie, who was previously on the podcast. Yeah, it was wonderful to see that, and actually, you know, made me feel like some pretty cool, like-minded friends. It was a nice reminder of that at a time when we're distanced from everyone, to be like, yes, I feel close to you guys again, even though I'm bumping into these people and I can't hug them. So no, absolutely, I felt proud being there. I felt proud marching. I felt proud chanting. I absolutely believe in that cause. You know, many people are talking about it in reference to George Floyd, but it 100% is an issue that happens here. Not just externally to the police, but also politically internally. I've got one person in my mind in particular that managed to, via a Freedom of Information request, get documentation of some comments that were made in a meeting about why they wouldn't look the part, and a few other phrases that I won't say. This is a universal issue. It was one that definitely exists here. You know, thank God our police aren't here with rubber bullets, for example. And just for quick reference on that, many people may not know that rubber bullets are actually quite a misleading term because they're not made out of rubber. They're made out of plastic, and often they have a metal core in them, and they can be as large as the palm of your hand. So they're far closer to a real bullet than they are to, let's say, a Nerf gun bullet. They are to be shot at the ground so that they can bounce up and they can create a kind of visual line where it's like you can see the bullets bouncing off the ground here, so don't come anywhere past it. They're not intended to be shot directly at anybody, particularly people's faces or journalists.
When people have them who don't use them correctly, and those people who let power take over, I can imagine they're used in a brutal way.
No, absolutely. And we've seen that with images and videos coming out of the States of people losing their eyesight and people having horrible wounds from rubber bullets all over their bodies. You know, I can't say that their protests should be peaceful, but then allow the policing of protests to not be held to that same standard. And so certainly for Birmingham, there was a good turnout for it, an incredible turnout, really, given the context of what's going on coronavirus-wise. And the policing was, I think, brilliant, the police response. You know, and I think...
Did you manage to keep any distance? Was it on your mind? Were you... I couldn't go because I was here with my daughters, but my partner went. He actually said, as a couple of his friends pulled up in their car at just outside the city, went in to walk in, and, or they were driving in, and they were like, oh, come and get in. Come, do you want to lift in? And he's like, no, don't. I don't want to get in your car. But especially as our community, the black community, you know, we're high risk when it comes to COVID-19. You know, we're in the at-risk category. So that's had an impact on how we've all been feeling about it. But I said, did you manage to keep your distance? Was it a factor for you once you got into it? I guess as you were walking towards it, you were aware. Did you keep that thought in your head, oh, I've got to stay away, or I've got to try and keep my distance, or not?
So it was a real challenge, and I don't think it was going to be possible whilst being involved to the extent that I thought it was important to be. So I did wear a mask. I did keep distance as much as possible. I did come across friends, but we didn't go within 2 metres of each other. But no, as part of the, certainly the marching part of it,
it's impossible.
It wasn't going to be possible. And, you know, and that's a difficult thing to balance, isn't it? And I don't have the answer for that. You know, I think it comes back to that Boris said, that the people will use their common sense. And I think that's all we can do. That's the options we've been given. So for me, the protest was so important that I couldn't not be part of it. And so I did my best. And I know many of the people that have been to it are now on a precautionary social isolation as well, to make sure that they're keeping others safe in hindsight. So it is a really challenging conversation, and I've seen a lot of back and forth online about it. And so one of the things that's really resonated with me is how people are saying, well, racism is a pandemic, and this was a pandemic beforehand, and it's not going away by itself. And so we can't just ignore one of these issues. I find that difficult to disagree with, really, that I understand people's concerns. But I don't think this is something that can go unmarked in history. Protesters that really resonated with me was two black women holding up separate signs. One of them says, increasing the risk of a second wave of COVID, decreasing the risk of a 450th wave of racism.
Wow.
In reference, I'm assuming, to 450 years of racism. Although, of course, we know, depending how you're defining it, how you're looking at it historically, we can trace it back far, far beyond that as well. For me, I wouldn't necessarily disagree with people that are saying you're taking a risk going to a protest like this. We're doing what we can to reduce that. And people, for the vast majority, are being peaceful. That risk is, for the vast majority, being mitigated. However, we can't talk about wanting to see change come out of this pandemic, wanting to see inequality that's been highlighted change going forward, and then have an opportunity like this to raise our voices and not speak up. To me, that would be going against, you know, our platform and what we try and stand for. And I guess a lot of it comes back to the lifting of the lockdown and a lot of people's concerns around that, that many people are struggling to understand the decision making behind it. We've seen examples where senior people in government have not followed the rules they've been part of setting. And it raises a lot of questions. It raises a lot of doubt of how this is being handled. And so I would argue that if it's safe enough to go back to work, and if it's safe enough for kids to go back to school, both situations which have been highlighted as places where there's examples where social distancing is impossible.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the key point to that point. Yeah, absolutely.
Then how is this different? You know, if we're being given the responsibility of using our common sense, and we're being encouraged into environments like workplaces, which for many of us, social distancing isn't possible.
Yeah.
It's hard to convince people, oh, well, you can't for this thing. And then you start to wonder about, is it because protesting doesn't directly support the economy?
Well, that is an argument. And to be honest, Bobby, I've not thought about it like that, because I've not even thought about the fact that they shouldn't be protest. I mean, I have thought about it, but it wasn't going to stop anybody. You know, I'd said to my partner, be careful, watch what you're doing. But it wasn't a thought of not to protest, really, or not to be part of it. But actually, you saying that is a really interesting point, because you, protesters, you know, if they're sensible, potentially aren't going to touch each other or hug each other or do all the things, share things like six-year-olds are going to in a classroom. If we're completely honest, it's a really good point, because what you know, I don't want to need to repeat what you've just said, but you're absolutely right about the government and their confusion, or the rules become then blurred. We're all adults at this protest, and we've all got gloves on and masks, or not gloves necessarily, but masks, most of us. I know I said I wasn't going to repeat myself and yeah. or you, and I just have.
No, but
it's a key point. I'm going to take that with me. Actually,
yeah, but it is worth repeating. And to come back to something we mentioned earlier about it being illegal to gather in groups of more than six, I've never had a workplace that I've been in where there's been six or less people that work with me. And yet none of us are expecting for arrests to be made in offices or factories or other places of work right now. And I think that's the question you've got to ask yourself. And that's part of how I was able to rationalise it. I just felt that it was something I couldn't not be a part of. I believe in the cause. I have a very diverse group of friends and colleagues around me, and this matters. I know how discrimination has impacted friends of mine personally, and so when I think of racism, I think of their faces, and so that's who I'm letting down. So, you know, will I go to Birmingham City Centre for a friend so that I can chant and I can march? It seems a small price to pay, and it seems a relatively small risk in my position when I don't know a single friend who's a person of colour who hasn't experienced racism. I know a great many friends, almost all of my friends, who have not caught COVID-19, as far as they know. So there's, you know, there's different ways of looking at this. The last thing I want to mention for this part is, for the sake of balance, that there have been many protests that have strictly observed social distancing, quite a few in Northern Ireland that you can look up, and you can see they're even chalking boxes of 2 metres that people individually protest in.
Really?
Although, of course, we know Northern Ireland is far less densely populated. So perhaps it's possible there in a way that it's not here. Anyway, with all that said, we'll talk about this a little bit more and continue our general conversation about how we're doing in lockdown. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out. And so we're back from our ad break, and as always, we find out after the episode has gone live, in most cases, what that ad was, hence why I have my pre-recorded line of who's our sponsor, let's find out. So it may even be one relating to the pandemic. We've had a lot of those recently. So, Danielle, I know you had some questions you wanted to ask me.
Yeah, well, you mentioned...
Why are you facing the wrong way? I'm not going to be able to hear you.
Because...
Where have you gone?
Because I'm here, because if I'm here, because my legs are off the bed in front of me, I've got 2 laptops and a mic. I can't get my legs out, so I have to. My legs have got to go somewhere, so they're hanging off the bed. And when they were bent, they were sore. But I'll bend them. I'll bend them for a bit longer again. Okay, I have to swap my position every now and again. I'm not at a desk. Yeah, I wanted to ask you. We spoke earlier. You mentioned the change and how important it was. We're really looking forward to supporting change. I've been thinking for a while about this, and although we have seen protests and campaigns for far too long with regard to racism, as far as I'm concerned, that we're still out there having to protest that our lives matter, one thing that we've never spoken about or discussed as much as we have this week is white privilege. I say us, I mean society, because we do talk about it all the time. And I just wondered, from your point of view as a white male, what that means to you.
So I think it's a really good question and important, because a lot of people are offended by the concept of white privilege. And I think for a lot of people, that's because they see it as an affront to their experience, particularly their experience of struggle. People are saying that you've had an easy life, and that's not the case. That's not really what it means. Maybe some people say that, but that's not really what the concept is about. Instead, it's where you have privilege relating specifically to skin colour. And I think, quite a good insight into that, given I live in somewhere diverse like Birmingham. I have a similarly diverse friend group. And so I've heard a lot of experiences friends of mine that have had of discrimination that I've simply not had. So for that reason, no, white privilege doesn't offend me. I think it's an important thing to discuss. It doesn't undermine anything I've been through. You know, it doesn't mean that I've not experienced mental illness. It doesn't mean that I've not experienced struggle in my life. It just means that certain things could have been harder. I think that's the way to look at it. Rather than things being easier, maybe you switch it round and that's an easier way to understand it, that things could have been harder for me if my skin colour had been different. Maybe we should mention, I'm very white. I had a joke with my sister the other day where she said, isn't it weird that we're not even a skin colour when it comes to foundation and makeup? So our shade for the foundation she uses is 0.5. We're not even a whole shade.
Not even one.
Not even one. So, you know, I'm aware that when it comes to being light-skinned, I'm very, very light-skinned. And that relates not just to discrimination, that relates more broadly to how you're seen. I have, for example, family that live in Malaysia, and I went over there a few years ago and was shocked. I mean, obviously, I've been over before, but I was old enough to notice this time. I was shocked by just how many ads there were for skin lightening. You'd be driving along the road and there'd be ads with very light skinned or white people. And it was not only horrible to see, you know, how much whiteness was being put on a pedestal there, but also it was in a completely unachievable way. You'd go into some stores and you'd see that most of the models on the photos were white people. You know, it went even beyond the idea of skin bleaching and other lightening products, but it was, no, you have to be this person. You know, it's not possible. I don't think most white people look like Keira Knightley, let alone Malaysians. And that's an example that luckily we don't have in this country. But, you know, it's an example of how global this issue is. You know, working in modelling, I've seen how my career is different to black models that I work with. And I've seen how the pressures are different. So, for example, with you being mixed race, that's part of the factor in the hair type that you have. And so you don't have those tight Afro curls. And for a lot of people in the modelling industry, they're selected for having hair like yours because it's seen as more aspirational. And beyond that, a lot of people don't even know how to work with Afro hair. And it's been incredibly jarring at times to have to sit there when I've helped train models and explain that to them, that part of the reason they may be struggling to get work is because of discrimination. I never want to have that conversation, but I feel lucky in some ways that I've seen enough of these experiences to understand what is going on.
You're right, there is progression. It still surprises me. I was on a website the other day looking at clothes of my daughter. I was surprised to see actually the amount of black models for young children that there were. You know, if I open, and I'm surprised still, and I'm pleased that my children at least are looking at, my daughter's 9, looking at clothes with me, and every other model was Asian, black. And I smiled inside. I was so happy. But it made me think, oh, my goodness, I didn't grow up with any of that. I didn't grow up with any of that around me. I didn't see any of that, and just took for granted that models were white, or, you know, and had long hair. And this is just what you saw when you looked at images. And now, yeah. I'm pleased to say, we do see more. There's still a long way to go. And you're right, with hair and things like that, it just means we need more people of colour working behind the scenes. Let's be real. Like, let's get some black girls doing hair for your shoots. And then you don't have to worry about, oh, I can't deal with Afro hair. I don't know what I'm doing with it and all that stuff.
Yeah, and that's actually, there's loads of examples of that, which can be kind of litmus tests, that if you are keen to learn more about how race affects people's lives, when you're next to the hairdresser, ask, do you have a set default person here that deals with Afro hair, or is everyone trained in it?
And actually, I mean, we could go on about hair all day. It's a whole new episode. And actually, ironically, I will say for the masses out there, my dark-skinned child has got these luscious curls that are down, this gorgeous long hair. And my lighter skin child that people have often associate with softer hair and whatever, it's got really tight afro hair, and I love this nuance and this difference with them. It's amazing. But I wanted to say, just talking about that, hearing you, I could talk to you all day about this kind of stuff, and your knowledge is amazing. I mean, you're getting black products sent to you. You've got it all sorted. You know what's going on.
Yeah, so for the listeners, part of the reason why I understand a lot of the hair context is because I have curly hair myself, and so hair products.
Bobby researches black hair products. Like, he knows it all.
Yeah, so no, I feel like I should mention it, because although it's a bit off piste for us, the majority of products you'll find in places like Superdrug and Boots are actually designed for thinner blonde hair. That's actually the hair type that they are most suitable for. And so even if you have curls like I do, which are actually quite big curls and a lot easier to work with in many ways than other types of curly hair, it's still the case that black hair products are far more suitable for my hair and for the moisture level it needs and for the specific requirements of different hair types.
Oh, and it makes me laugh.
And so that's why I know about this stuff, partly.
It's just hilarious. I love it. But only because you mean hair and beauty.
Yeah, but also, you know, that is one of the benefits of integration and one of the benefits of diversity, because my mum has similarly challenging hair. In fact, many people in Ireland have thick, wiry, curly hair, which I sometimes joke is really great for protecting you from the rain, but isn't so great at styling and looking nice. And so, you know, she grew up, and when she was little, they didn't even have conditioner. You know, that was a new thing.
Wow.
And so, you know, that's the contrast. Whereas I've been able to access knowledge about these things and how people from different backgrounds navigate hair care and find the right thing for me.
Well, absolutely. And although that might sound a bit tongue-in-cheek, and we've joked about that, on a reel, like, you, your history, your knowledge about not just black history, but minority history and the impact it has is incredible. And I've really enjoyed my getting to know you and hearing so much stuff from you about that. So it just leads me to my last question. I just really want to know, do you feel at all like, hold on, we're not all fucking ignorant, like, some of us do know what's going on? And I've not really heard, it must be out there, who are like, hold on a minute, we're not all like this.
There definitely is a lot of that out there, yeah. But, you know, it's layers. And it's, I guess, the way I could maybe parallel it with mental health, for example, is, you know, the stigma has to end. You know, that's another thing we're hugely passionate about. And we're very outspoken about ending the stigma. And with that, you know, there are times when we have to look at ourselves and realise that we could be stigmatizing. You know, we've, for example, both grown up being used to the term commit suicide, which has a history in suicide being a crime in this country, and hence it was something you committed as you commit a crime. And that is language that we, as a society, luckily, are moving on from. And we've had to actively learn different ways to phrase it, like referring to someone taking their own life or someone dying from suicide, as examples of alternative ways of saying that more appropriately. You know, and that's not to say that we are purposely stigmatizing. It's not to say that we are by default bad people. But oftentimes, in order to make progress, we have to look at ourselves. Everyone does. You know, just because I'm someone that experiences mental illness doesn't mean it's impossible for me to stigmatize against someone else's mental illness. And that is the kind of similar nuance. So even though I am someone that has some understanding, and part of that is, you know, having the experiences of diversity I've had through my life and living in Birmingham, it's also to do with my background being Irish. And, you know, a lot of the times I can inadvertently experience racism, like people having rants about immigration to me because it's something on their mind. It's not necessarily something people are directing at me. I have had experiences where, when challenging that, I've said something along the lines of, well, you do realise when you're talking about immigration, you're also talking about my family coming from Ireland. And a few times the response to that has been along the lines of, oh, I don't mean you. It's different. You're white. I mean those other people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and to me, that's where it crosses a line, and it's not an immigration issue, it's a race issue. And so, you know, I've had enough experience to know that. You know, so on one hand, yes, I do have white privilege in many settings, and I've experienced that where things have been said to people that have not been said to me. And I've not got a single friend who's a person of colour who can't list off a whole range of experiences of discrimination they've had based on skin colour. So me acknowledging my privilege doesn't undermine the fact that I've also had racism diverted at me.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've had that where I worked in a call centre before, and quite a few people, when hearing my voice and how I sound, immediately said, oh, I'm so glad I got an English person. And I'm actually not English. And sometimes I would say that, particularly if they then went on to have a rant about all these Indians in call centres, I can't understand them. Why do you put them in there? And I'd look around at my colleagues, and many of my colleagues were also from minorities like I am. But, you know, maybe our background is different enough that I sound white British on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and before, and again, I've had the same thing where I've said, oh, actually, I'm Irish, so I'd really appreciate you not saying that. Or I might say, you know, a lot of my colleagues are from different backgrounds. I'm not going to accept you speaking about people in that way on this call. And, you know, sometimes the challenge I would get is, oh, well, you know, I just mean it's easier speaking to a white person. And mm-hmm. So, you know, again, it's that privilege. But then there's been plenty of situations where I felt excluded because I wasn't British enough. It goes both ways. None of understanding white privilege, I think, undermines that nuance.
Well, it doesn't. Not you think it doesn't. It doesn't. You know it doesn't. And that's the message that's being misconstrued, isn't it? That's the message that people can't seem to get. Like you said, you have experienced discrimination, all of these, yet you can still hang with the fact that, yeah, there's white privilege there, and I've also been afforded that too. Like, regardless of the things that you've been through, we're talking about this situation. So I guess from both sides, I kind of, as part of me, and I'm questioning this all the time, I'm being really true, being mixed race and having a white woman with blonde hair and blue eyes, like, and a dad who's black, my culture and background and both sides are so important to me. I guess I've connected to the black side and been around my black family more. And again, maybe that's even the fact that the white side's just there, like the privilege of just white people are just everywhere. Like, that's just what you know. Like, you've got to make sure that you stick. Do you know what I mean? You have to find it within your black, you live within your black people and make sure that that stays within you.
Yeah, but also I think there's a structural racism element to that. Certainly in the United States, there's this idea of the one drop rule. And this actually comes from laws that, thank God, have now been removed in the States, where you could be discriminated on the basis of having even a drop of what was referred to as Negro blood. So that's where this idea of the one drop rule comes from. And for many people, that still exists. So even if you were mixed race or very light skinned, or, you know, you weren't black, you were from a different community of colour, the fact that you're even a little bit not white is enough for you to be considered the opposite. And so for many people, you would be considered black just by taking a look at you, irrespective of shade, irrespective of asking you about your
Absolutely.
Background. You know, and that affects us all badly. You know, nobody wins in that scenario. I have to explain my perspective all the time, because otherwise people will get really confused when I talk about the British as something separate to me, unless they know about my background. If they just see me on face value, they may not assume that, even though actually in many ways, like my gingerish hair and my complexion and, you know, some and elements of the language I use, apparently narrow wrists and ankles is another one that a lot of people say is an Irish thing. You know, there's all these ways in which I do look quite stereotypically Irish, but predominantly you're seen as your colour in many cases. And that's something that I would argue affects us all badly. You know, it's stereotyping. I'm an Irish person that doesn't drink. I'm a testament to stereotyping that doesn't work. I'm very proud of the progress that's been made in this country, but there's so much further to go. And I do feel like at times it can be really under threat. And that's why marching and showing up is important, but also showing up in other ways. You know, if marching isn't for you, and I completely understand, particularly right now, then there are other things you can do. You know, check in on a friend of colour, because I can tell you every single one of them will have thought about what's going on right now. You know, when I've had friends that have had racism directed at them because of speaking up about this, that again is not something as a white person I experience. I can speak up about racism and nobody's going to turn around to me and say, well, of course you're going to say that, you're black. You know, this certain, I'm not going to have a racist backlash from doing that. And that is part of my privilege, but that's also, to me, part of my responsibility.
Absolutely. I was just going to say that. And you're right. We've all had a really traumatic week. Bobby, I've had to tell my children what's going on. Like, it's everywhere. They can see it. I've got a 9-year-old and a 6-year-old that are like, what? Even now, I've all week been having to double check myself and how they're feeling and checking in on them and making sure they're okay. And it brings questions. They're not sure what does that mean. What do you get what I mean? Although they know about racism, my older one does, and she's got books and we know about. But I really have always tried to, until maybe now, promote the brilliance of black people and the magic and the amazing colours and shades and talent and skills and all the things that we are. That is what I've always tried to show my children, so that they see that. Because if I left it to society and the media, there's problems and black people are disadvantaged and we're struggling and or we've got a chip on our shoulder or whatever it might be. So I've constantly tried to make them be aware of how amazing all people are, but they're you know, they're people, and to have to talk about it now and talk about what's happening in 2020. Like, I found it really hard, really traumatic to go through that really with them and with my partner and my family, you know?
Yeah. And that's why it's so important that these conversations are had. And, you know, that again, coming back to what we talked about earlier with, you know, us both finding this a really challenging week. I've faced a lot of people that are very confused about what's going on. And I've been at times quite surprised that they're confused. I've had, you know, friends of mine where it's affecting their relationships with others. I'm trying to help them then navigate that, or navigate, you know, the difference of perspective that can come with having a different skin colour. That actually we shouldn't have a different perspective on this. That because our experiences are different, it can be difficult to reconcile that. And so, yeah, some really difficult conversations. And, you know, none of this is to say that I've only ever been in accepting diverse spaces. You know, the sixth form I went to, all kinds of discrimination were rife. A lot of LGBT discrimination, anti-Semitism. You know, this was already common and I'd not been in an environment like that before. So I ended up challenging it a lot. And, you know, things that I kind of took for granted. You know, I'll give you just one example. The sixth form I went to was in Stourbridge, which is generally considered a white working class area of Greater Birmingham, and it's not as diverse as where I live now. In my sixth form, in my year, there was one Asian girl. There was other areas of diversity, but specifically, there was only one Asian girl. And I remember there being fierce debate in my first few days of this new school, where both me and her had joined at sixth form, about whether or not she was Muslim. You know, and it was along the lines of, oh, well, you know, she's brown, so like she probably is, right? And other people saying, but she doesn't wear the scarf thing, so she can't be. And then people being like, oh, well, I think not all of them do. And I think I could pick up on enough context clues and her name to know that she was probably Sikh. And I think I had a mutual friend that confirmed that from another school. And one of the times I brought that up, I had to say that a few times when these debates kept happening, which I found very surreal, you know, that this was such a hot button issue for somebody where I'd grown up being around people from backgrounds like hers. You know, it wasn't novel to me in the way it was novel in this environment. And so, you know, when I said to a few people, oh, she's Sikh, I remember there was one time, maybe a table of 10 guys having at lunch together, and not a single one of them had heard of a Sikh. They had no idea what a Sikh was. And, you know, and that's mind-blowing to me. That's 2% of our population. and the ice cream van is back. So, you know, there's experiences like that that have given me perhaps a broader perspective in all directions, where I'm like, okay, I get that some of how weird that conversation was for me was from a place of not understanding. I don't think it was all with malice, although, I mean, some of it was quite dehumanizing, the way they were speaking about her, and some of the language, like the P word being used. So it's been a week of having a lot of conversations about this. You know, many of my friends are upset because of how racism affects them. Many of my friends are trying to better understand how much racism doesn't affect them.
And I think that's a key word to say, actually.
But it may be affecting their relationships right now. It's pretty exhausting. But as I said to one of my friends when she was asking me about this, it's important for us to speak up and understand as white people, because if we all do that, not only will things change, but also people of colour get a day off. You know, that as much as it's hard work for me talking about race, and it is a difficult thing at times to speak about appropriately and know the right things to say and kind of try and balance all these different perspectives and life experiences, you know, that can be quite exhausting. But however much exhausting it is for me, it's way more exhausting for the people that don't have a choice about having the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
People might assume, as a white guy, I don't know much about this, and not ask me about it. If you're a person of colour, this is going to be a conversation in your life, probably forever. As much as things change, I don't see race not becoming a factor in people's lives anytime soon. And so that's what I said to her, that, you know, even if this just gives some of your friends a day off from having to speak to people about this, because you're also having the conversation and you also know some of the answers, that's something. That's powerful.
I think that's an amazing way to end. And I think that's key, because the bottom line is everybody needs to hopefully check themselves and think about how open they are in every way. That's something that's really hit me in the face this week. How open are we all to all types of people from all types of backgrounds, genders, cultures, sexuality? All of that. How open are we all? How open can we all really honestly look in the mirror and say, I'm cool with anyone from anywhere who does anything? Really? I wonder how many, you know what I mean, Bobby? That's really hit me this week. And you just mentioned then, which I quite like, about that's all we're saying. It's not about the rest of your life or what you've dealt with.
It's not directly a criticism.
Absolutely.
That's the important thing.
Seems to be taken, yeah, but it seems to be taken that way. That's where the arguments are coming in.
Yeah, well, it's an uncomfortable conversation for a lot of people, and I 100% understand that. But it's important, and certainly to link it back to mental health, you know, it's important to stand for destigmatization on every front. That's how we make real progress. We can't be for destigmatizing mental health, but then ignore how certain mental health issues affect people from different backgrounds differently, or how discrimination exists in all kinds of forms. You know, we've talked about how discrimination can exist where you're not considered thin enough to get help with your anorexia, or you're considered to be from a background where you should be fine to figure addiction out on your own, so you won't get the support.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or you're not prioritized in different ways, or the waiting lists are too long. You know, there's all these factors that create inequality, and we can't just be for one of them.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, mental health, to bring it back again, is massively a part of this, the trauma that racism creates. And only this week I had a conversation with a friend who was bullied at school by a girl who called her the P word and who called her a curry muncher. And this same girl then was posting Black Lives Matter content and posting about how it's not okay to discriminate. And she challenged that because she was like, well, you know, where was this sentiment all these years ago? I still think about the way that you treat me. You know, it still upsets me to think about that. And this girl didn't really apologize. Instead, she tried to justify it as, you know, I was a stupid child. At no point did she apologise. And I think that's a lot of what my friend wanted. You know, that's some of the closure that she wanted. And, you know, you may think that you can see both sides on it, but the point I made when talking to her about it was, well, this person has children. So when she's saying, oh, I was a child, well, then you wonder, okay, well, your kids, do they know any better?
Mm-hmm.
Would you accept them calling someone at school a curry muncher? Because if the answer is yes, then you're missing the point. Absolutely. Also, not for nothing, this happened when they were both 16. So yeah. And there's another debate about at what stage of life you do know better.
Yeah, you're not five.
You know, that trauma is very real. And these are things that people struggle with and can massively affect people's mental health.
I think it's time we stop saying, I don't, I'm not, and do I, am I, you know? Just start questioning what we might think we do and don't do.
Yeah.
With regard to all stigma, and especially, you're absolutely
all,
right.
All stigma, health. Absolutely. And my slogan for it would be, don't say it, prove it. You know, if you care about mental health, show up for it. Check in on your friends. Look after your own mental health. You know, this is universal. You know, right now it's Pride Month. And, you know, the ways people would normally celebrate that have changed because of the pandemic. So, you know, it's important to also check on our friends from the LGBT community and see how they're doing. And did you want to talk about Black Lives Matter as a slogan? Because I know there's been conversation about that.
Well, I think the principle's the same. I agree, of course, all lives matter. But again, nobody's saying anything about any other lives at the moment by saying that Black Lives Matter. Right. And we want to talk about the fact that Black Lives Matter, because it seems in a lot of places that they don't. Frustrates me a bit.
I get that. And that's why I wanted to kind of close on that, because there's something I saw the other day I thought was really interesting, which was tweets about this and, you know, different ways to explain why, again, Black Lives Matter shouldn't be an offensive thing. You know, it's highlighting the lives that right now they're forgotten the most frequently. And a tweet I saw about that was that it's like saying to someone that's just survived coronavirus and is trying to tell you about it and tell you how much they suffered and how difficult it was to overcome. If you then turned around and said, well, you know, all viruses matter. Why aren't you talking about the other viruses?
Yeah, that's a really good way to talk about it, actually.
Or someone gets breast cancer and you say, oh, all cancers matter. You shouldn't go on a breast cancer run. You shouldn't go on a breast cancer march for better care, because what about the other cancers? You know, just because you take a cause doesn't mean it's the only cause you can take. I guess that's what we're saying.
Absolutely. I really like the way you've put that. And as you quoted from a placard that you'd see, which I also saw a girl with a little sign. I'm on Instagram now, actually, looking at this. Well, I took a photo of it. A little girl holding up a sign said, we said Black Lives Matter. We never said only Black Lives Matter. We know all lives matter. We just need your help with Black Lives Matter, for Black lives are in danger. And I just thought that was absolutely brilliant. No one ever said shit about anything else right now. Like you said, the way you just put that, that's brilliant, actually. I'm pleased that you've armed me with more examples now when you try and talk about
I've got so much. Yeah, but it's important, you know, it's, you can't always win people over. So sometimes it's good to have other things to fall back on. And so the last thing I'd say to round up then is that if you want to continue this thought and go and consume something that is only a few minutes long, which has some really interesting quotable perspectives on this conversation, go listen to White Privilege 2. It's a track by Macklemore and Ryan Lewis with Jamila Woods. And I'd really recommend it for more conversation like this, loads of things you can quote, and just something that's, you know, maybe serious, but also lighthearted. You can bob your head whilst also being like, oh, that's some good points.
Yeah.
In the meantime, check in on each other, look after yourself as well. Don't forget about self-care. We'll be back for our final episode of this COVID-19 and mental health series next week, with a very special guest. That's it.
Take care, everyone.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.